And with a look at the conditions in the backcountry, on the phone with us from the Utah Avalanche Forecast Center, it's Greg. Good morning, Greg.
Good morning to you. Yeah, you just heard about the winds, and the winds have really been a player with recent avalanche activity. So winds have been out of the south, generally shifting between the southwest and southeast, and they've been blowing moderate to strong. Mid elevations, they're gusting in the 30s, and on upper elevations, some gusts in the 50s. It's been really windy, particularly along the Park City ridgeline. There were six avalanches reported from the backcountry on Thursday. Three were natural and three were skier triggered, and a couple were along the Park City ridgeline. The notable one was South Monitor. This naturally avalanched on Wednesday, and then the continued winds just loaded the slope again, and there was another avalanche again on Thursday. This is 2 feet deep and up to 500 feet wide, running on those weak faceted layers that formed back in November and December. So the wind has really been the player, and we're going with two avalanche problems today. One, wind-drifted snow, so these moderate to strong southerly winds, they've been sustained, not gusty, just sustained blowing moderate to strong. They've been drifting snow on all aspects at the mid and upper elevations, and even into some of the upper reaches at the lower elevations. And so they've been creating these dense slabs of snow, and they're very reactive on Thursday. Again, those six natural inhuman triggered avalanches reported. I think any drifts you find today, they may be over 3 feet deep in places, and then any avalanches, they may propagate over several hundred feet wide. Also finding some evidence of cornices. So these are wind-drifted snow that just appears right along the ridges. And so there's been some evidence of some sensitive cornices that have been forming as well. Also, our persistent weak layer problem. So we have wind-drifted snow, and in some areas what it's doing is it's overloaded these buried persistent weak layers that are 3 to 4, even 5 feet deep in some places. I think that South Monitor repeater avalanche is primary evidence of that, where that persistent weak layer of snow exists, and all it takes is just another load of wind-drifted snow, and we get an avalanche on it. Additional forecast and snowfall, you just heard, we're going to be getting more snowfall later today and overnight, and continued winds today. It's just going to add additional stress to these deeply buried weak layers. So you're going to find these problems. This persistent weak layer on mid and upper elevation slopes facing west through north and east. So today we're going with a high avalanche danger on upper elevation aspects facing west through north and southeast. At the mid elevations as well as southerly aspects at the upper elevations, we have a considerable danger. So these strong southerly winds, we have dense slabs of fresh wind-drifted snow, and also some storm snow expected later on today. So we're advising people to avoid travel on, underneath, or adjacent to slopes steeper than 30 degrees at the mid and upper elevations. And fortunately, this dense snow has been riding really well. So you can actually get out of wind-affected terrain and ride low-angled slopes and avoid being in avalanche terrain. And I think, you know, be able to travel relatively safely outside of avalanche terrain.
Okay, be careful out there.
Yes, indeed. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Thanks. Well, stay tuned. Coming up on the local news hour this morning, I'll be checking in with Peace House Executive Director Kendra Wyckoff, Park City Mayor Andy Bierman with an end-of-the-year reflection of 2020 and a preview of the state of the city, and Sundance Film Festival programmer Heidi Zwicker talking about the world cinema slate in this year's fest. Well, taking a look at some local news now, organizers of the Sundance Film Festival went virtual yesterday for the press conference opening the 2021 online festival. But they said that while the event had to be limited for the COVID-19 pandemic, the spirit and ideals of Sundance have not changed. KPCW's Rick Bruff has more.
The Thursday morning press conference was scheduled on Utah's Mountain Standard Time, like the rest of the festival schedule. Although the three hosts were online, their virtual background was the Egyptian Theater, the traditional site of the press briefing. Tabitha Jackson took over the job of festival director last January, not knowing she was headed for a year like no other.
What the pandemic had done was to kind of explode our present reality from then And we were left with these pieces. And the festival actually is coming from a place of needing to completely reimagine and take the pieces that we know are part of our essence and build them into something different to meet the moment.
Also speaking to the press, producing director Gina Duncan said the past year was like flying a plane while you're building it. But Sundance Institute director Kerry Putnam said that fortunately they had 10 months to learn from other film festivals going through the pandemic. Jansen said they were apprehensive about how many submissions they would see during the COVID year, but their numbers were just slightly down, mainly in U.S. films and mainly in narrative features. She said there was actually an uptick in non-U.S. documentaries, and artists responded to the challenge.
Because artists are so creative and they make art by any means necessary, we also got films that were made in COVID, and that's reflected either in the subject matter or in the form, distanced casting and setting. And it's been interesting, and for us to be able to be one of the first showcases, if not the first showcase, for the creativity that came through a pandemic or is being made in the midst of it.
The festival is almost entirely online. Sundance has 28 satellite locations in 24 states and territories, but organizers decided for health and safety reasons to drop the Ray in Park City as a live location. The films are free, though attendees won't be able to chat with people afterward on the streets or shuttle buses about the films they've seen. However, Jansen said they are trying to recreate the synergy, in part, with a program called Film Party.
You go over to the New Frontier platform, which is very easy to do, and if you go to Film Party, each feature film that is premiering, after the Q&A, you can go there in your avatar and talk to people about that film. I mean, literally talk to them, hear them, see them in your avatar. You go into a special little lounge to talk about that specific one. So making sure that that conversation, that discourse around the work, and that connection of audience to audience, and the artists are going to be there too, audience to artist, fingers crossed, but I think it's going to work.
During the press conference, the hosts took questions about how the festival continues to support diversity, how they are guarding their online films against piracy, and how a film's prospects for acquisition look at a digital festival. In addition, Sean Means from the Salt Lake Tribune asked what elements they might take from Sundance Online and implement in future festivals.
The possibilities of reach and access and participation to a global audience, that I want to carry through in whatever way seems appropriate. You know, we're always going to have too many people to fit into Park City. We're always going to have people who simply can't either financially or physically or geographically make it to Park City. So this additional dimension, I think, is really exciting. But we haven't started the festival yet. And so what I want us to be able to do is to remain open and notice the possibilities and opportunities that present themselves, and also notice the things that we tried because we wanted to try them, but they didn't work.
Finally, Kerry Putnam said she hopes the Sundance community can meet in person for 2022.
I'll speak for myself. I can't wait to be back together in a collective experience and back in Utah, back in Park City.
Sundance Institute Director Kerry Putnam. For KPCW, I'm Rick Bruff.
Well, the COVID-19 pandemic has touched every facet of our community, from the economy to our mental health, to how many people we're putting on a chairlift, and the Sundance Film Festival. It's also touched our nonprofits, and one of those especially challenged by the coronavirus has been the Peace House. On the phone to talk about some of the challenges and how they're coping with them, I have the director of Peace House, Kendra Wyckoff. Good morning, Kendra.
Good morning, Leslie.
So talk about some of the biggest issues that Peace House has had to face due to COVID-19.
Well, I think, you know, first and foremost, we were deeply concerned about the impacts of the pandemic on victims of domestic violence and the increased risks for abuse and violence that we were hearing and also seeing in our work early on. We also were very, very concerned about how we could respond as a nonprofit organization that serves victims of domestic violence by addressing the increased needs, but also how do we do that safely during a public health crisis? And so it took a lot of work on behalf of our team to really work on protocols and policies and ways that we could creatively address the public health issues on our campus while continuing to remain fully operational.
Yeah, so when you talk about increased needs, I mean, do you have numbers that show that? I mean, and I guess given the fact that you're in a new shelter with more room, you certainly can accept more victims, yeah?
Yes, right, Leslie. Well, I think we were looking at a couple of different indicators. One of the indicators that we saw very early on during the pandemic was the increase in calls that we were receiving for help and support. So that would be through our helpline or through our community business line. And that was, I think, a true indicator of the increased needs that we were seeing in the community, because we saw about a 50% increase over the prior year. And what we were hearing on those calls were people reaching out and asking a lot of questions. They wanted information about resources and support. But early on during the pandemic, it was much more difficult for them to potentially engage in services because of some of the shelter-in-place mandates, which caused, you know, a ripple effect for victims in their home, where they might have had increased exposure to their abusive partner because their partner was working from home. They may not have had access to some of the resources that they had in the past, like friends and family, because of the increased isolation. And so we saw a lot of people reaching out through the telephone lines and through our helpline to ask questions. We did a lot of safety planning with folks during that time. And then we have seen increased requests for our residential services. You're absolutely right. We do have some increased capacity with our new campus. And so we are seeing that we're able to serve more individuals. But we've had a 34% increase in the number of shelter nights that we've provided since last year. And I think that all of those are indicators of the increased needs that we're seeing in our community.
Yeah. So you've been in the new facility for what, almost about 18 months now?
Yes, going on about 18 months. We settled in September 2019.
Yeah. And in terms of what you're able to offer there, I mean, is it fully occupied, or can you not do that because of the pandemic?
That's a great question, Leslie. You know, early on during the pandemic, we worked closely with the Department of Human Services Office of Licensing, which provides a license for our emergency shelter services, and also the Summit County Health Department to really determine what's the best course of action. How do we provide residential services on our campus and really work hard to mitigate risk? And initially, we moved all of our emergency shelter residents into transitional housing units because the emergency shelter has communal space, and that is a high-risk situation for individuals and families who have fled abuse and need a safe place. So the units that we had in our transitional housing wing were self-contained apartments, and we were able to support the safety and health of our residents because they had kitchens and living spaces within those units that really significantly decreased the risk of exposure and transmission for our residents. As we continue to work through some of our programming, we also implemented a telehealth platform that allowed us to support counseling and case management and legal advocacy services so that our clients had access to flexible care. We recognized that there were some situations where an individual could not access services through technology, so we continued to remain open as well for walk-ins and some in-person services. As we started to kind of emerge from that shelter-in-place mandate this summer, we started to work towards operationalizing some of our longer-term housing units for transitional housing. And in September, we were able to pilot two apartments and bring those online. But because of the very high risk of the virus being, you know, transmitted in residential or congregant care, we still continue to use transitional housing units for our families so that we can reduce risk. Those that are coming in for emergency shelter, we're still using some of those units for emergency shelter. In addition, we also needed to use a couple of those units for circumstances where individuals need to isolate or quarantine because they've been exposed or may have symptoms of COVID-19.
Wow. So explain. So you've kind of got the emergency shelter, which is the more like, kind of like dormitory style, right? Where you say a lot of communal space, and then you've got transitional housing. How many beds there?
Well, we really like to refer to them by the units rather than beds, in particular because, you know, right now you really cannot have individuals who are from different families in the same unit. So we have 12 units of transitional housing and 8 units of emergency shelter.
Okay, and then you also have the 2 long-term units? Is that what you're – I'm just trying to figure out how many you've actually got.
Yes, I know. It can be a little confusing because we're using some of the units in, you know, creative ways, again, using some of those transitional housing apartments to provide emergency shelter. But the 2 units that I referred to are actually part of the 12 transitional units.
Okay.
And most recently, we actually were able to bring 2 more units online in that wing. So of the 12 transitional housing units, we have 4 that are being used for transitional housing. And we have 6 that we're continue to use for emergency shelter for families so that we can continue to support the public health issues on our campus in thoughtful ways and reduce risk. And we have 2 units that we use for isolation or a quarantine situation where somebody may have exposure.
Okay. So have you been able to keep your staff and other residents then safe?
Well, I feel... you know, very fortunate that through this time, we have been able to keep our residents on our campus safe. We have not had a confirmed case of COVID on our campus with our residents. We've had a few staff that have been impacted by the virus, and thankfully they have been able to, you know, heal and recover, and they're doing well. But that really is at the top of our priority list, is really working to support the health and safety of everybody on our campus. Our life-changing and life-saving services are so critical, and we would not want to be in a position where we would have an outbreak on our campus that could potentially put us, you know, in a position where we would have to shut down or reduce our emergency shelter capacity. So we feel very fortunate that we've been able to employ these protocols, work closely with the health department and the Department of Licensing, and we have been doing relatively well in terms of being able to protect the health and safety of people accessing services on our campus.
Yeah, so do you require, as people come in, to be tested, at least so you know what you've got?
Well, we have a couple of different protocols in place, Leslie. We provide health screenings to our residents and employees on a daily basis. We're working on a routine testing. We just recently had a partnership with the health department where they were able to provide some COVID tests to our organization so that we can do some routine testing with our employees and residents. We really work very hard to support everybody in having the mask mandate, you know, social distancing, and addressing issues as they come up. If we do have anyone who expresses that they have symptoms or they've been exposed, we work really hard to make sure that they're getting connected to the appropriate type of testing or medical care that they need. So it's really, you know, a day-to-day effort by our entire team and by the individuals that are residing on our campus to address the challenges with the pandemic.
Yeah, it just sounds like such a huge juggling game. I mean, given the limited space and the need for services as they arise, have you had to ask people then to leave because you don't have the room to take care of everybody?
Our team works really hard with wraparound services and support to provide the care that folks need while they're residing on our campus. You know, our emergency shelter is short term, so typically the length of stay historically has been around 30 days. We have seen that length of stay increase during the pandemic where people need longer periods of time to be able to get connected to resources. But our support services, they work very closely with each individual on our campus to connect them to a number of different supports to help them transition, whether they're, you know, transitioning to an internal program within Peace House or an external resource in the community. we actually have a team that works on housing. And that's been a particular area of great need that we've seen during this time, the housing needs for survivors. It's been really challenging. It's taken longer for folks to be able to gain employment or to get housing. And our housing team works specifically with individuals to help them identify what resources are available. If there's some financial assistance needs, we have some emergency funds that we've been able to access and utilize to help get people transitioned into other resources in the community. We also work really closely with other partners in our local community and across the state to address the needs of domestic violence victims, whether that be a domestic violence service provider or some of the social services and safety nets that we have here in our local Summit in Wasatch County.
Okay, because I recall, early on is that we had some of the lodging properties actually kind of donating units. Is that still happening?
As needed, we've had some of those lodging units. As of the recent period of time, we have not been utilizing those, but we've used some emergency assistance to help with hotels in circumstances where folks have needed support and perhaps we've not been positioned because of capacity to be able to provide that immediate shelter. And again, working with those local programs in the state of Utah to address those needs that are coming up day to day.
All right. But if somebody needs help, you're going to make sure that they get it.
Absolutely. Our staff works very, very hard to address those individual needs. Everybody has their unique needs, and there's a lot of complexity, I think, that people are facing right now. And we really want our community to know that we are here 24/7 available to provide services. The fastest way to get in touch with a victim advocate is through our our helpline number, which is 1-800-647-9161. And we work to try to connect individuals to those Peace House services, as well as other services in the community that may meet their needs.
Okay. Kendra, anything else you wanted to mention?
Well, I just want to say, we're really grateful for our community partnerships and the generous support that we have received over this period of time. We know that it's been a particularly difficult time for everybody in our community and across our state and really across the globe. And we are here completely committed to providing that wraparound support and service that is deep, really, really critically needed during this time for domestic violence victims. Our services are available 24/7. And if anybody is having difficulty getting connected, please reach out. You're more than welcome to ask for me or Tim Savage, who's our Director of Program Operations. And that 24-hour helpline number is 1-800-647-9161.
Kendra, hey, thanks so much for your time this morning.
Thank you, Leslie.
That's Executive Director of Peace House, Kendra Wyckoff. Well, with a look back at 2020 and a look ahead to the coming years, on the phone I have Park City Mayor Andy Bierman. Good morning, Andy.
Good morning, Leslie.
So for many, 2020 was basically a year of just rolling disasters. I mean, it was the pandemic, the job losses, schools closed, the George Floyd death, the racial protests, the riots, the forest fires, and then an election with that a few people still refuse to accept. Here locally, a year of one cancellation after another of some of our favorite events that kind of make Park City, Park City. Our arts and culture organizations, of course, still shut down. So how do you assess 2020 for Park City Municipal?
Well, you summed it up pretty well. It was a crazy year. It seems like about everything that could go wrong did. And it started off certainly with a lot of energy as we wrapped up our Community Vision 2020. There was a lot of excitement to move forward with things, and then it very abruptly came to a halt when the pandemic hit. And so I've been referring to 2020. It feels like a gap year in terms of moving forward on things. But the reality is, despite the fact we had to do an awful lot of retooling to adjust for health and safety issues and a lot of rebudgeting to adjust for the economic impacts and offer a lot of support on a social front, we did continue to make progress on a lot of our goals and our community priorities.
Yeah, so in terms of our unemployment numbers, I mean, they certainly aren't where they were before the pandemic hit, but in town, it still feels as busy as ever. Have you had any updates from Ski Utah in terms of where we are in terms of skier days?
You know, Leslie, I haven't. I've heard, I think the sales tax numbers are being processed right now, and we're going to see those. I'm hoping to see an update at our council meeting on February 4th. I've heard that once again, they've exceeded our expectations. Our expectations were pretty low. We had expected about a 40% drop in sales tax, and I think we've done considerably better. Certainly not having Sundance here this year and having the lower snow. I think our numbers are going to be down based upon what we were used to. But I hope that many of the businesses in town and many of the workers have adjusted their adjusted accordingly, lowered inventories and staffing. And then for those of us that depend on the service industry job or the jobs or the tourism jobs, hopefully we've been able to adjust our household budgets and stuff to prepare for a tough winter. And we're pretty hopeful that starting this summer, we're going to see things ramp back up towards normal. But I'm with you. I'm surprised how busy town has remained despite all the travel concerns.
So you said February 4th, you do expect to see those sales tax figures then?
I'm hoping. I'm told they're working on them now, and so they should be ready by then.
Okay. Well, I mean, construction nonstop. Good luck getting a contractor. Of course, the ski resorts are open. The restaurants are open. The real estate market is booming, which I think makes it even harder for local full-time residents to get into the real estate market. So what is the city? What should it be focusing on? I mean, what's fallen in between the cracks?
I'm not sure what I would say anything's fallen in between the tracks. I think you going right to housing, that is certainly the area where it seems like COVID has made the most acute effects in that it continues to drive prices up. I think I was looking at something that came out from one of our local realtors the other day, and they said the median house sale right now is just under $2.5 million. And that's jumped up. Last time I looked at that towards the end of last year, I think it was just under 2 million. It was 1.9 or so. And that's really into the realm of the absurd for anybody that wants to live and work here, unless you're coming in with quite a few assets. And I would just compare that. I was looking the other day at how that compares to some of our resort town peers, and it has jumped even ahead of like Breckenridge and Vail, and it puts us in the right up there with Aspen in terms of unaffordability for living here. And at the same time, construction costs have come up greatly. Land has become more scarce. So the city continues to push on our housing program. And luckily, we have acquired some nice parcels of land we can build on. But we can barely adjust to the rise in building cost as quickly as it jumps back up again. So we're really happy that we completed 7 new affordable units over at Woodside Park this year. And those units also, they're 3-bedroom and 4-bedroom condos with a studio apartment. So right now we've got 12 new residents we're able to move in. And there were also 15 new deed restricted homes that went in 2020 in Park City Heights. So we continue to move that needle forward, but not nearly at the rate that the demand continues to rise.
Yeah, what's the status of Woodside Phase 2?
It is on hold at this point. Council, the seniors wanted to change direction and not move, so we don't have resolution there. We had a appeal in place from one of the neighbors that had concerns about the density. So council has just put that project on pause, and we focused our efforts over into the Bonanza Park area, looking at the Arts and Culture District and the Homestake Lot as our next project. So that's been frustrating to all of us. We were hoping to be in the ground at this point and working on that project, which I think was supposed to bring about 50 new units online. But unfortunately, that hit a couple of hitches.
Yeah. So I do have a senior center representative coming on the show next week. In terms of that, so you're just going to let them be? Because you've kind of you've reallocated the money that you were going to build the new center with there at the Mawinney parking lot.
Yeah, for the last decade, we've been working under the assumption that the seniors wanted a new facility with more versatility and something they could expand with more programming and space. And we've been working towards that, and we've gone through a couple of different iterations. But most recently, they've said they do not want to move. They don't want to change things. So at this point, council decided to honor that, and we're going to have to retool whatever we eventually do at Woodside to work around that.
So looking ahead at 2021, I mean, you're planning your annual State of the City update at the end of February. I mean, what's on the horizon for the city's agenda? Sounds like Arts and Culture District is right there at the top of the list.
Well, yeah, certainly Arts and Culture District has been the center of all of our conversations right now. But it's really, I think that what we're hoping to have ready for the State of the City is we're trying to consolidate, we're trying to merge sort of our past, our present, and our future in terms of how do we approach those strategic pillars that the community brought to us through the Vision 2020 and combine those with our longstanding community core values and then the community critical priorities and sort of merge that all. There's huge overlap in all those areas. And we're going to sort of merge those into all, hopefully, one simplified message at the State of the City. And then the council retreat will be the following month. And at that point, we're going to revisit our goals. I think, I was saying at the retreat, Leslie, the council will hopefully spend most of the retreat discussing our goals towards those community pillars or priorities and action plans to achieve those.
Okay. So when we talk about Vision 2020, I mean, that was last year. Is that something, though, that we build on, though, for the next 10 years before we do kind of a Vision 2030? Or, I mean, how...
Yeah, I think it is. Certainly, there's always, we always have to adjust. Trends and situations change. We might have to alter some of our priorities or our sequencing. But I really think if you look at the four community priorities around transportation, housing, equity, and energy, those all came out with slightly different names, but essentially the same thrust in the visioning. And I don't see those. Those are all almost generational goals. So I think we're going to be working on those for quite some time.
Okay. So it sounds like you're back and forth with whether or not you run for re-election. Have you made a firm commitment to move forward with that? March, of course, is usually the filing window for that.
Yeah, I didn't want to spend the entire year campaigning and or have the drama and the speculation of whether I'd run or not. So I've made it very clear that my intent today is to run again, but I'm not going to make an official declaration until I need to in June, because there's a lot of other things I'd like to focus on right now.
Okay. Hey, anything else you'd like to mention?
No, I just want to let people know. I hope usually the State of Park City is a celebratory event for us. It's not terribly formal. We try to get the community together and eat pie and celebrate what we've accomplished over the last year and look forward to the next year. This year is going to be a little bit different. We're going to do it virtually, but we still hope to have a community celebration, and it's going to be the evening of Tuesday, February 23rd. So we encourage people to come out and join, and we're going to hopefully keep it short and fun and say hello to everybody.
Okay. Park City Mayor Andy Bierman, thanks for your time this morning.
Thanks, Leslie.
Well, the Kimball Junction Traffic Analysis Survey deadline is coming up February 12th. UDOT wants public feedback on four alternatives, which are high-level designs to address traffic problems in the Kimball Junction interchange. KPCW's Carolyn Murray has more.
The survey is a joint effort between UDOT, Summit County, and Park City. UDOT's Region 2 Planning Manager Grant Farnsworth said the four options evolved from public input given in the previous Kimball Junction neighborhood planning surveys and community meetings held last year.
We want to make sure that this area serves people that are living in the area, that are passing through the area, if they're walking, if they're riding a bus, or if they're driving And so that this tries to make sure that we're improving the quality of experience of all of those types of users.
The second alternative in the survey involves a road encroachment on the High Ute open space conservation easement. Farnsworth said once they narrow down options, they'll do a more in-depth analysis of capacity, mobility, and multimodal transportation solutions. He said alternative two, which infringes on the conservation area, was brought up by neighbors during last year's public input.
We wanted to be pretty expansive in our net of options that we considered. One that was brought up to our attention with the Kimball Junction neighborhood plan that was done and was considered during that time period. And so we're trying to be as broad as we can and understand that, you know, some of these alternatives will definitely be weeded out.
Summit County Council member Glenn Wright said he would never approve of that option. He believes there is only one viable alternative.
And I'll be quite upfront with everybody on it. I think alternate three there is the only viable option. And I would like to modify it further, as I stated during my questions to UDOT during that presentation. I don't think the other three really help us at all.
Farnsworth said they'll do additional high-level environmental analysis once they've narrowed down the alternatives. They've received 150 responses to the survey, which closes on February 12th. You can find the survey link on kpcw.org. Carolyn Murray, KPCW News.
Well, there are 20 films in competition for both the World Cinema Dramatic and Documentary. On the phone to highlight some of them, I have Sundance Senior Programmer Heidi Zwicker. Good morning, Heidi.
Good morning, Leslie. Thank you so much for having me on.
Yeah, thanks for being here. So you are a senior programmer. Does that just determine how long you've been with Sundance? Or?
Partly I think it does. I also do like a lot of categories, a lot of different things. Unlike a lot of other programmers, I do both features and shorts. It's just additional responsibilities. But yeah, I think partly it means I'm old.
Okay. So how long have you been with Sundance?
This is my 11th festival.
Oh, wow. Okay. How many films did you actually receive submissions from around the world? Do you have that number?
I don't have the exact number, but what I can tell you is it's pretty consistent with what we've received in past years, which was a huge surprise to us and is a huge testament to the filmmakers and artists working now that we received, you know, close to that 15,000 number that we've received in past years. It's amazing to see people working and creating great films in this time. And so we had a really hard job. It wasn't entirely what we were expecting, that we would see so many wonderful submissions, but we were lucky.
Yeah. Are there films this year from places you don't normally see?
Absolutely. We actually have a film in our World Dramatic competition this year from Malta. And there haven't even been that many feature films from Malta ever. And it's a really amazing, beautiful film about a fisherman portrayed by a non-actor. And he does just an amazing job. It transports you into this fishing village in Malta. It's a really special movie. Our day one World Dramatic film yesterday was a film from Thailand called One from the Road that people can still catch in its catch-up window. And that is another like really exciting part of the world. We don't see a lot of films at Sundance from. And it's a beautiful, romantic, melodramatic, in the best kind of way, tearjerker film that we're really, really proud to support.
Okay. We should note that the one from Malta is Luzu. Is that how you say it? Luzu?
Luzu, yes.
Okay. Okay. Now, do you personally have a look at all of the films, or do you just kind of consider those that are considered world competition, world cinema?
As a programming team, we actually make final decisions all together as a group, so we actually all see all the finalists for the lineup and discuss them at length. So I definitely have seen the most international films, but ultimately we see all, as we go through our process, we all see all the films and we decide together. And that actually feels really great to like work with the wonderful, supportive group of programmers with such a great variety of tastes and backgrounds and making decisions together. It feels like the right way to do it to me.
Yeah, and it looks like, Sweden is probably the big winner in terms of submissions this year. Let's take a look. Go ahead.
Oh, yeah, no, absolutely. We have two fiction films from from Sweden and a few documentaries from Sweden. This is a great Swedish year. If I'm just going to, off the top of my head, call out just a couple, I do want to say that tonight our midnight film from Sweden, Knocking, is premiering, and that's a personal favorite of mine for people with genre tastes. It's about a woman who's kind of trapped in her own apartment, and she thinks something sinister is happening in the apartment upstairs, and it's so suspenseful and well-crafted and has an amazing lead performance. So for those people who like a genre film, I highly recommend Knocking, which is playing tonight.
Okay. So you mentioned some of those playing in the dramatic competition. Talk a little bit about some of those that kind of caught your attention in the documentary competition.
Well, we do have an amazing film called Sabaya, which is technically a Swedish film, although it's set in a very different part of the world, about women who are being held captive and rescued. It's almost, you know, I don't want to dismiss it by saying it feels like a thriller because the stakes are so incredibly high and human, but it is an incredibly suspense to watch, but also a really important film. And we also have, you know, Flea, which is our day one world film. Again, it's a, you know, it's a Swedish film, but it's also, you know, taking place sort of all over the world because it's about a refugee from Afghanistan. Incredibly powerful, emotional film, really creatively done, using a lot of animation. They're just all works that we're really excited about.
Yeah. Now the Sabaya one, back to that real quick. I mean, is it's all done on mobile phone then? Because again, they're with, I mean, in a very dangerous situation, it sounds like.
Yes, most of the film is shot that way. And it really brings you there and you feel the danger. Absolutely. It's incredibly compelling and it's incredibly brave filmmaking.
Okay. And there's also another one from Australia, Playing with Sharks. That doesn't sound like a good idea, but...
Yes, it's a documentary about this subject. She is an extraordinary woman who's built her entire career around the study and relationship with sharks. And she was involved with Jaws. All that's kind of a funny anecdote within the film. But she has built her entire career around sharks, and she is like the shark expert. And she's an amazing, fascinating subject. And it's really a movie that it's a movie for everyone in our world documentary competition. It's an amazing subject that you would love to get to know.
Yeah. And then another one, I don't even know how to say it, the one from Ethiopia, Faya Dayai?
Faya Dayai, yeah. Yeah. That's a really beautiful, artistic, black and white, portrait into a culture in Ethiopia that, I certainly had no idea about. It's an amazing first feature from an artist that we supported in our shorts program a few years ago. So it's really special to see her come back and make such a distinctive feature debut, really artistically done. It's really special.
So is this, it's about the rituals of kat, which is a leaf that Sufi Muslims chew. Is it similar to the cocoa leaf?
Yes.
Ah,
yes.
Interesting. Okay. All right. In terms of... others that just kind of caught your eye?
I'm trying to think of movies that are premiered today. Human Factors is another film in our world competition. It's sort of a really intense domestic drama about something goes wrong while a wealthy family is on vacation, and they sort of all spiral apart in different ways because of this trauma. And it's sort of done almost like in a Rashomon style, where you see everybody's perspective of what has happened. But it's really a special filmmaking voice, another one that I think people should check out if they haven't seen a world film before. Human Factors is a really great one to look at. And I will, say we have some good U.S. films too, of course. How It Ends is playing today, and that's a really fun one, directed by Zoe Lister-Jones, who was at the festival before with Band-Aid, along with her husband, Daryl Ween. It's a really sort of fun, thoughtful look at Los Angeles at the end of the world.
Okay. So again, people can just go online, festival.sundance.org. They can buy individual tickets.
Absolutely, yes. Individual tickets for a lot of screenings are still available, and you can buy them and watch the films today. I do recommend if you buy a ticket and you watch a film, you join the waiting room. 15 minutes before the screening, and that's what allows you to actually participate in the chat and the Q&A after. I have to say, you know, I have to just mention that, you know, we've been planning this online festival for so long, you know, for health and safety reasons that were really important. But, you know, last night it really launched and it's really real. And you know, I got to see audiences joining together in the chat and submitting so many great questions for the first ever post-world's premiere screening that I did from my couch. And it's really wonderful to see people coming together as a community in this new online forum. And I hope people check it out.
Yeah. And can you talk just a little bit about what to expect? Because it's just so different than, you know, what we've ever done before. As you kind of go into the film you're expecting, it's kind of like you're waiting, and then all of a sudden just kind of like this button appears to say that you can actually kind of get in.
Yes, exactly. So like if you select a film, you can put it on your schedule. 15 minutes before, you can click join waiting room. And if you click that little join waiting room button, you'll be in a chat with other people watching the film. You can press play and see some pre-show content for those 15 minutes. And then when the film begins, the chat obviously goes away because we want everybody's attention on the film itself. And so you can watch the film. You can, because this is an online world and things come up, you can pause it if you absolutely have to, which is a convenience. And then when the film ends, there's another button that will pop up that says join the live Q&A. So you can see those Q&A on the screen on the same platform, but you can also chat below and submit questions below that screen.
Okay. Heidi, anything else you'd like to mention?
No, I just want to say thank you again for having me on and say that, you know, I think I, like a lot of my colleagues, are really missing Park City right now. So I really appreciate the chance to talk to you and the Park City community about our films this year.
All right. Heidi, thanks for your time this morning. That's Heidi Zwicker. Well, Film Lovers, last night were welcome to an online Sundance Film Festival for the year. During the virtual ceremony, which included a message from Sundance founder Robert Redford, organizers said they're using a new format but have not given up on their core purpose. Redford was heard in a recorded message which took a cosmic perspective on independent film, Sundance, and the past year.
Every artist holds a mirror to their piece of the universe. They make the hidden visible, the unknown familiar. Even though we have been separated, we're still bound together. We dream under the same sky, filled with stardust. And that same stardust formed the deserts of Utah, our festival home. Surrounded by caverns and caves, and the mountains, where years ago, early artists left their mark.
In her remarks, new festival director Tabitha Jackson said that the festival responded to the events of a turbulent 2020.
This festival was conceived as a grand experiment, a response, actually, to loss, the grief of a pandemic, the uncertainty of an economic crisis, and the pain which elicited a global uprising in the face of racism and police brutality. But this loss brought new clarity, clarity around our belief in the necessity of the independent voice, our belief in community, and our conviction that freedom of creative expression is a powerful and necessary response to repression and autocracy.
Jackson said that in planning a festival during a pandemic, they focused on the words, what if? They decided that rather than have audiences come to the festival can come to the audience.